This broadcast will come to you from London, New York, Washington, and Tokyo. We have in our studios Senator John Sherman Cooper, Senator Ralph Flanders, Mr. Chester Davis, and Sterling Fisher, moderator. This week, the representatives of 16 nations of Western Europe sent to the United States a preliminary statement of their position and of the help they wanted from us. Is it going to cost us more than we can afford to help Europe, to help Asia? What is it likely to mean to your pocketbook and to mine? On this broadcast, Our Foreign Policy, we're going to hear these questions discussed in three world capitals. What is London thinking and saying now? Merrill Muller, NBC correspondent in the British capital, is standing by to bring you an up-to-the-minute picture. For his report, we take you now to London.
More than any other country among the Western European democracies, Great Britain lays claims to the moral right of economic aid from the United States, and preferably on a gift basis. This all stems from the remarks of Prime Minister Clement Attlee and opposition leader Winston Churchill on September 8, 1945, when the United States ended Lend-Lease. Mr. Attlee said in his speech in part, and I quote, "We can only reconvert gradually, and a sudden cessation of a support on which our war organization had so largely depended puts us in a very serious financial position. It would seem reasonable to regard such supplies and services arising directly out of the war as belonging to the common war effort," unquote. Mr. Churchill was more dynamic, saying in part, quote, "I cannot believe that so great a nation would proceed in such a rough and harsh manner as to hamper a faithful ally who held the fort while their own armaments were preparing," unquote. In his statement, Mr. Attlee hinted that it was the master production plan of the wartime allies which made Britain concentrate on military requirements only. Members of his Labour Party have since elaborated on this to condemn the United States for profiting, in peacetime, from the huge expansion of plant facilities which, they claim, were partly financed by the sale of British securities. Mr. Churchill's conservative opposition followed much the same patriotic line, becoming more vociferous when the terms of the American loan to Britain were heralded as the surrender of imperial markets, dollar diplomacy, and efforts toward the economic domination of Britain and Europe. More recently, cabinet ministers have publicly appealed for freedom from the dollar grip. Angry outbursts in the House of Commons have again produced the label loan shark. Unfortunately, and until President Truman's immediate activity on the European draft of the Marshall Plan, the only American reaction to all this has been the publication here of equally inflammatory statements such as Operation Rathole. However, nothing is further from the truth than the belief that Britain is standing idly by waiting to be saved by American effort. Most of this country is straining every muscle in the export program by which Britain hopes to pay her way, and which is currently about 20% over normal peacetime volume production. The great expansion of this program, announced by Sir Stafford Cripps last month, is a Herculean challenge to a nation that has suffered 7 consecutive years of increasing losses in blood and wealth and increasing austerity. The one weakness is coal. The one answer to Britain's road to prosperity is coal. The one national resource she could exploit to the maximum is coal. Lack of coal forced this country's trade into more competitive and choked markets, making the nation poorer, and causing political reasoning which surrendered wealthy imperial outposts and some markets. The coal weakness has forced the government to chop down the imports of food, tobacco, amusements, and gasoline in order to conserve the supply of raw materials. It has forced a rationing scheme of fuel and power and the compulsory staggering of working hours. It has also forced the coal miners themselves to voluntarily postpone their long-awaited 5-day week, though this is still being negotiated. All this, plus an appeal to the United States to assume most of the British financial burden in Germany, will cut Britain's trading deficit by half next year, when it is also planned that the export program will be some 65% above the nation's pre-war normal of 1938. If that isn't enough proof of British good intent, look at the Marshall Plan itself. In that document, Britain pledges to increase her coal output by 25% over the next 4 years, to start coal exports next year, and thereafter help supply Europe with coal and steel on an increasing scale. If that program can be sold to the miners here, Britain will be paying her own way by the end of the Marshall Plan. If that coal program fails, Britain has become a major scapegoat for her European neighbors, I return you to Washington.
That was Merrill Muller, NBC correspondent in London. Here in our studios in Washington, we have Senator John Sherman Cooper, Republican of Kentucky, Mr. Chester Davis, President of the Federal Reserve Bank, St. Louis, and member of the President's Committee for Foreign Aid, and Mr. Sterling Fisher, moderator. Senator Ralph Flanders, Republican of Vermont, is in our New York studios. To open the discussion, here is Mr. Fisher.
Now, gentlemen, you've just heard what London is thinking about the need for help. How does that strike you, Senator Flanders?
We can listen with appreciation to the statement of the British as to the contribution they made to the war and the way in which they held the fort while we were getting ready.
Now,
we owe them a great debt for that. We are somewhat worried by the strikes that have occurred in the coal industry, which is indicated in the broadcast, is a critical point in the whole economy of Europe. We have been worried by other strikes, and we are still somewhat worried as to whether the new social and economic changes made by the government are going to increase or hamper production.
That's fine, Senator Flanders. Now, Senator Cooper, let's turn to you. What do you think of that report from London on the aid problem?
The government in Great Britain has recently secured the enactment of an act called the Supplies and Services Act, which will come effective October the 1st, and which will inaugurate a period of austerity in Great Britain, which will match or perhaps exceed that of the war. It is a wartime program. It provides for the elimination of luxury industries and the direction by the government of labor to essential industries. It denies to the individual luxuries which we think of as necessities, and it will actually affect the quantity of clothing and certain types of food that the individual will get. As Senator Flanders has said, I think there are a great many people in this country who will question the ability of these controls to increase production. It will be argued that it, in fact, will reduce incentive. But I think it cannot be denied that Great Britain has made since the war and is making now a determined effort to build up its exports and to reestablish its ability to sustain itself.
Now, Mr. Chester Davis, as the only non-Senate member of this broadcast, I wish you'd round out the picture by telling us how this direct report from London seems to you.
It strikes me that there's mutual need for a lot of education among people on both sides of the Atlantic. Some of the comment will impress the American listeners as unfair. At the same time, England probably thinks it unfair when the suggestion is made that the British coal miners are more interested in the hours of work than they are in getting out coal.
Well, the 16 nations of Western Europe have issued, as everybody knows, a preliminary report on the total of their needs. That report says that the American people will have to decide whether they want Europe to recover, and it sets the price at $19 billion for 4 years. Now, gentlemen, I want to ask you this, and turning specifically for the moment to you, Senator Cooper, in offering aid on such a vast scale, Senator, hasn't the United States the right to insist on certain conditions?
Mr. Fisher, if you'll permit me, I'm going to digress a moment from the question of conditions and raise a question which I think must be considered by the Congress and the American people before they make a decision in this matter.
All right, good.
And my question is this. Will the $22.4 billion, which has been proposed by the European Economic Commission in its first summary as being the sum necessary from the outside, be sufficient to meet the needs of these countries and establish their rehabilitation? If you study the summary prepared by the Commission, it's evident that the estimate of $22.4 billion is based upon several assumptions. It's based upon the assumption that they'll receive help from the other countries on this continent. It's based upon the assumption that there will be a betterment of world conditions, and that evidently that there is some that the impasse between Russia and the United States will be resolved. And it'll be noted also that it proposes that in this next few years that there will be substantial trade between the participating countries and the countries to the east, the satellite countries who refuse to participate in this program. And also it indicates that the Germany must participate in the program and that there must be a substantial recovery in Germany. I think that all of these assumptions raise this question as to whether or not the amount proposed is enough. We remember that at first $29 billion was suggested in the papers, and later it was reduced. I personally believe this, that it's just as important that a sufficient sum be made known to the Congress and the people if it is necessary, as it is to indicate or as it is to question whether it's too large or not. We should know. And we would fail in the whole problem, and it would be a palliative instead of a cure, as Secretary of State Marshall said, if we started out with the assumption and upon the base that a certain sum would do the job, and then we find out later that it will not.
Well, I'm certain, Senator Cooper, that that is a very vital question, although those sums that you suggest are simply staggering. But here's one I think that a lot of Americans are concerned about, and that is whether we should be troubled much about the assistance we are giving to a socialist government in Britain. Senator Flanders, what do you think?
Well, the suggestion has been made that we should put conditions on the arrangements we make with Great Britain.
Yes, that's
that
right.
She should even change her form of government. That does not seem to me to be wise or just or possible. We should be less concerned with the question as to whether Great Britain is going socialist than we are with the question as whether, in so doing, she can still remain productive or increase her productivity. It is on that basis that we must judge her rather than on the political ideals she is following at the present time. We must judge her on an economic and not on a political basis.
I see. Well, now, Mr. Davis, there is a question of pricing policy in France. So the whole question of sending food to France on the basis of prices there, what do you think of that?
Well, before I go into that, I'd like to address myself just a minute to your main question about
right.
conditions. It
Fine.
Seems to me that Secretary Marshall, in his June 5th speech, laid down the most important condition of all. He asked Europe to draw up a program for concerted action to achieve maximum production and economic stability so that American exports and financial assistance over the next 3 or 4 years can be geared to that plan. Now, this general report that's been referred to and which has just been received in this country outlines such a program, and if it's carried out, of course, it meets that basic condition laid down by the Secretary of State. And I wish that report could be read by every adult in this country. Now, as to the French grain production, the problems there and elsewhere on the continent, by all odds, the most important cause of this year's short crop was the weather, that is, winter kill and drought. As you suggest, the general effect of inflation and bad pricing policies has been to hold down deliveries from the farmer to the cities for human consumption.
Now, Senator Flanders, going back to you, is there some question, I think there is some question raised by a lot of people in this country about what use France is making of grain that we're sending over there, or of her own grain, or of both?
It is reported, how truly I do not know, that the French peasants are feeding the wheat to livestock instead of turning it into the miller for flour, simply because they can get higher prices for meat in the black market than they can in selling it direct to the miller.
I see.
I imagine that Chester Davis knows more about that than I do.
Well, I don't know about that, Senator, but one basic trouble, of course, is that the cities have so little to trade which the farmers want, including the currency. If the program laid down in the 16-country report we're talking about can be carried out, it will cure that difficulty, not only in France, but elsewhere as it exists. And I want to say that from all the reports that I have heard, they are making a real effort over there to get the grain from the farmers and as much as possible into human consumption.
There are a lot of these internal questions that it would be hopeless for us to endeavor to solve or to police. And I also, having read that report of the 16 nations, feel that they are accepting in good faith the requirement that they exhibit the maximum amount of self-help. And these internal questions of the sort we just mentioned, so far as France is concerned, will have to be left to the French government and the French people.
Well, Senator Flanders, that's a very encouraging statement that you make there about the reliability of the 16 nations. Now, we want to resume in just a moment, but we have first a report to come in from Tokyo, which is set for just about this time. So if I may interrupt, we'll turn this over to the announcer who will take us to Tokyo.
At the beginning of this broadcast, we announced that we would hear from Tokyo. Europe is only one phase of the struggle for world reconstruction. What is the situation in Asia? For a report from George Thomas Folster, NBC's correspondent, we take you now to Tokyo.
This is George Thomas Folster in Tokyo. As you know, the Marshall Plan does not apply to Japan. The Marshall Plan does not apply to any country out here in the Far East. However, when one looks at the record of the occupation of Japan, it is interesting to note that General MacArthur's self-help plan has been in operation in Japan for the past 2 years. It all started with the most important and very natural shortage of food in this conquered country. MacArthur released thousands of tons of food to the Japanese. The Japanese seemed to lean a little too much on this handout. MacArthur rapped the knuckles with a directive to the Japanese government, which said, do a better job with your own foodstuff. Clean up your distribution system, help yourself. Or no more American food for the Japanese. The Japanese have helped themselves build up the trade balance by manufacturing raw materials shipped into Japan from other nations. It must be admitted, the Japanese are pitching in to rebuild their beaten, burned-out nation. To be sure, the Japanese haven't much with which to work. The little they do have, the machinery and raw materials, transportation, is severely controlled. This looks like socialism, but any so-called experiment with socialism in Japan today is born of economic necessity. For instance, General MacArthur has just endorsed a new Japanese bill to control coal mining. The government must allocate materials, just as Washington had to control the distribution of raw materials in the states during the war. The Japanese are natural-born traders and are looking forward to a free market. Japan must have help, and she hopes to get a lot of it through foreign trade. In their hearts, the Japanese realize there is little hope of a typical free-and-easy handout from Uncle Sam. You know, of course, that the Japanese have a pot of gold. Like any nation, Japan has a gold reserve. This gold reserve was frozen at the end of the war, but recently MacArthur said that the Japanese could use this gold supply as collateral to help themselves. The details are still to be worked out, but you can be sure that bankers all over the world are interested. Besides this need for actual financial assistance, Japan wants and expects food and raw materials from the United States. At the same time, Japan has not lost sight of the great East Asia co-prosperity sphere, and now it looks as if we must help in achieving it. Obviously, at the present time, Japan cannot contribute in a big way to the recovery of East Asia, even to the rehabilitation of Korea, which Japan may drive. Japan is a deficit country. She cannot even support herself. Indeed, Japan, to become self-supporting, must build up her Asiatic market. And Japan realizes that even increased trade with the United States will not be enough to make her self-supporting. And it is not in the interest of the United States to have a bankrupt Japan. The price of leaving Japan to work out her own problems today would be economic chaos, which breeds political instability, the result of which is usually war. This is George Thomas Wilson in Tokyo. I return you to Washington.
Now, gentlemen, while Mr. Folster was talking in Tokyo, you were taking down notes on the situation in the Far East in respect to the Marshall Plan. So I want to turn first to you, Senator Flanders, and ask if you'll comment on the situation in Tokyo.
That is a most interesting report. The primary problem, of course, in Japan is simplified by the fact that it is one country instead of 16 or more than 16, and also that it has been handled by a top authority with authority. Yet, simple as it is, the report gave some hint of the difficulties existing and the difficulties to come. I imagine that one of the most difficult parts of the Japanese project will be letting go of it in the right way. And for that, that we do it in the right way, we can only hope and pray.
Well, now, Senator Cooper, you also were listening very intently to that, and I know you must have some ideas about the Far Eastern situation. What do you think?
Well, I was interested in Mr. Foster's comment that it would be necessary for Japan to build up its Asiatic markets. As I remember, before the war, the great export of Japan to this country was raw silk, and that now is tremendously decreased and may not be recovered because of new competitors in the field, nylon. And I think that is very necessary, and if they must build up their markets in some other way if we're to get off the hook, to sustain them by the export of food to them, which they must have because of their very low food production. I think our commitments in Korea and China demand that that be done.
That's fine, Senator. And now, Mr. Chester Davis, what points did you find of particular interest in regard to the Far East and relation to this plan?
I guess what impressed me was what wasn't in it. I wish someone in the Far East would perform a miracle and get the production and shipment of rice back where it was before the war.
We'll speak to Mr. Foster about that tomorrow. And now, we've heard from two world capitals, gentlemen, and it would appear very evident that if we are going to play a decisive role in world reconstruction, something is going to be involved in the way of a sacrifice and of self-discipline for the American people. Just how much will there be in the way of sacrifice and self-discipline, do you think, Senator Cooper?
I think it will be necessary to make much greater sacrifices than we've made at any time since the war. The thing that disturbs me is that from all sides, there seems to be the feeling that we can evade some of the sacrifices. I'll give an example. I think that if there's not enough food to go around in this country and for Europe, if there's not enough steel, if there's not enough coal, it means simply that there must be less use of durable commodities, or we must eat less of food. I was very much interested in the president's suggestion that we waste less, but I think we'll have to go farther than that, that there'll have to be a reduction in what we eat. I think that means that we're going to have certainly voluntary rationing, but if prices increase, it may be necessary to go farther than that. I would never like to see it come back. I don't think OPA could solve the problem because it can't add to the amount of any commodity. But I think in the use and distribution, it might be necessary if these prices increase that we might come to compulsory rationing.
Now, Mr. Chester Davis, I think you're especially qualified to comment on the question of the possible success of voluntary rationing.
Well, let me say right here that the government rationing and price fixing won't work either unless they're strongly backed by public sentiment. And with that kind of backing, I believe, and Senator Cooper suggested, that a lot can be accomplished by an intelligently directed program of voluntary self-restraint. That's really the only way we can act now. There's no legal authority for direct controls, and it would take a long time to get it, if it could be secured at all. I wonder what Senator Flanders has to say about that.
I was interested in a suggestion made at the New York price hearings that recognizing the difficulty in getting back to the full paraphernalia of retail price controls and rationing, we might try to simplify the thing so far as food is concerned by getting back to price control on the farmer and the primary markets. That looked a little bit dubious to me, but, Chester, I'd like to have you comment on that as a possibility.
Well, as I see it, the real food problem this year is to prevent too much of our big wheat supply from being fed to poultry and livestock. And price control over sales of grain from farmer to feeder just won't work. I think, on the other hand, that organized self-restraint at the grocery store and meat market will check rising prices for animal products and lessen the demand for high-priced wheat for livestock and poultry feeding. Now, we have plenty of wheat for human food at home and for generous exports, too, unless the hen and the cow and the hog get too much of it. If it comes down to it, really comes right down to the question whether livestock here or men and women and children abroad are going to get it. In spite of high prices, we are eating more meat and eggs and poultry than we ever did before. And even with high wheat exports, we will still have enough grain and protein concentrates, hay and pasture, to take good care of our animal population if we will only use those resources efficiently and economically. I think by teamwork we can do a job.
Mr. Davis, if I may interrupt just a second, here's a very important question as our time draws near an end. I'd like to ask Senator Flanders, what about speculation in the grain market, Senator? What factor is that in this whole situation?
May I go back just a moment to what Mr. Davis said? The hearings here in New York brought evidence that there were at least a third of the population here to which further rationing cannot be applied. That is, that there is a very large group of people in this city who are now not getting that increased meat, and that point should be made clear. It's the rest of us who want to do that voluntary rationing. Now to get back to the grain markets.
Yes.
The grain markets are not merely a useful but a necessary institution. They make possible the movement of grain in an orderly way from the producer through the processor into the markets and to the consumer. And operating properly, they set prices that in the long run represent supply and demand. It has appeared to some of us, however, that the volume of transactions at times is such, and the purposes and the experiences of the operators at times is such that the market accentuates fluctuations rather than giving them a normal course. And we have been wondering whether we were not now in the peak of an accentuated fluctuation upward. It was for that reason that the suggestion was made a little time ago that we increase the margins on the transactions on the boards in Chicago, Kansas City, and Minneapolis. The Chicago board made a slight increase in the margins. It was asked yesterday by the Secretary of Agriculture that it increase that to a third of the cost of the transaction. To this, the authorities did not agree, but they offered to make from this point on a half of the increase as the amount added to the margin.
Now, Senator, I thank you very much, sir, and I hate to interrupt, but the time is very near an end.
I just want to say that should be tried, I think.
Right. Well, very well, sir. Now, I'd like to summarize in just a half second, very quickly, the points that we've covered on this broadcast. We've heard from London and Tokyo how things look at the present critical world situation. You've discussed the preliminary report of the 16 Western nations of Europe in which they set the price for their survival at $19 billion over 4 years. Europe wants us, it seems, to import more goods to help her become self-supporting. And you discussed some of the implications of aid to Europe in terms of the self-sacrifice and the self-discipline necessary for Americans.
That was Sterling Fisher, moderator for this series. On this broadcast, NBC went to London and Tokyo for up-to-the-minute reports from its correspondents, which were discussed in our studios by Senator Ralph Flanders, Republican of Vermont, Senator John Sherman Cooper, Republican of Kentucky, and Mr. Chester Davis, member of the President's Committee for Foreign Aid. The general topic of discussion was the Marshall Plan and your pocketbook. During October, NBC's series on our foreign affairs moves to another time on this network. It will be heard on Sundays over many stations on the NBC network. Consult your local paper for the time it will be heard in your area. At its new time, this series begins a new fall and winter schedule, which the Public Affairs Division of NBC hopes will make it one of the most important radio programs in the country. This series is coordinated by Murray Dyer. Stuart Finley speaking from Washington, D.C. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.